Tony Runkle has been with the Minnesota Geological Survey for a number of years, and he's been a very good guy to work with over the years. And he's going to talk a little bit more about not quite the big caves that Todd was working on, but some of the more intermediate flow features.
Well, I appreciate the invitation to speak to you all. I don't know how many were here 2 years ago, 2007 at MGWA, but I spoke at that time as well with a title somewhat similar to the title you're seeing here. You know, to be honest with you, I didn't even start prepping for this talk or even thinking about what it was going to include until about 3 weeks ago. Started to envision in my mind this succession of slides set up in a certain way to show bedding plane fractures and flow meter logs and that kind of thing. And at least in my mind had it all pretty much planned out, and I thought, well, this will be easy to put together. As I put together all my illustrations and looked at some of my old PowerPoint talks, I quickly realized that the talk I had ingeniously created in my head was virtually identical to what I spoke on in 2007. All right? So I didn't want to do that to you all here. And that problem is reflected in the title up here. It says, Macropores in Paleozoic Aquifer System of Southeastern Minnesota, What We Know and What We Don't Know. That wasn't the exact same title 2 years ago, but that's the way the talk went. In other words, I spent a lot of time on bedding plane fractures, which you're still going to get a lot of here. And then we got to vertical fractures, and I had one slide, and I said, well, you see them all over in outcrop. You see them in boreholes that have been blasted and baled, and they look like genuine natural fractures, so that to some degree they're present but probably largely closed in the deep subsurface. The end. That's all I'm going to say about vertical fractures. What I'm going to do today, where this talk is going to differ from 2 years ago, is I am going to still review and add some new information on bedding plane fractures and their relative correlatability or relative predictability of bedding plane fracture systems. But then I have perhaps foolishly added at least one third of this talk to be focused on vertical fractures. And maybe giving us an indication instead of calling vertical fractures something we don't know anything about, maybe we do know enough about certain techniques and concepts that can be applied to the Paleozoic rocks in Minnesota that we could rephrase this as what we will soon figure out. And maybe you'll agree with me, and maybe you won't agree with me on that when I get to the vertical fracture part. I'm going to move on here, but before I do, I just want to go over these objectives. The objectives here that we're after are, if you come away with anything from this talk, it's that you should be convinced that there are macropores in all bedrock, and that doesn't mean just in outcrop. Anyone who's looked at these outcrops has seen that there are macropores in the outcrops, but that there are macropores in the bedrock in relatively deep conditions of burial as well, and we'll demonstrate that today, and that the macropores are hydrologically important, and we'll show that, for instance, through flow meter logging, that kind of thing, where we can document flow speeds within a borehole or the amount of water going into or out of macropores. And last, to kind of summarize at the end of the talk, the whole talk is set up in a way where I think we will be demonstrating that we can indeed map macropores. We can predict their stratigraphic position and thus map them. Early on, when we became interested in trying to characterize macropores or secondary pores and fractures, that kind of thing, in the Paleozoic rocks, many people were interested in this, but there was an interesting comment Bruce Olson once made to me. He said, Tony, this is all great stuff. You're learning a lot at site-specific scale. You are providing some insights into the fracture flow system in the Paleozoic rocks of southeastern Minnesota. But he said, for my purposes and what we do here at MDH, we can't use any of this unless you can map it. You have to give this to us in maps. And what I want to argue or show you during this talk is that I think the progress we're making on characterizing macropores will lead us eventually to the degree of knowledge necessary to map these features. Okay, one slide on just basic overview of what the Paleozoic rocks of southeastern Minnesota are. because I'm assuming most of you know this. The Paleozoic bedrock of southeastern Minnesota was deposited largely in a marine setting about 505 to 350 million years ago. All right, it's a relatively shallow sea, and in that sea, there was laid down a number of very widespread yet thin rock layers, or sediment layers, and those sediment layers would commonly be composed of three different sediment types. There would be coarse-grained sand layers, like you see here at the bottom. There would be very fine-grained sandstone, siltstone, and shale, which you see here in the brown. And doesn't show up too well on the color here on this slide, but there are green layers that are composed predominantly of carbonate rock. All right, the last cross-section you saw extended from the Twin Cities metropolitan area south to the Iowa border. Okay, it spanned about a couple hundred miles. Most of the cross-sections you're going to see from here on out in this talk are spanning roughly west to east across the Twin Cities metro area. Okay, so it's a somewhat reduced part of the Paleozoic section, but it's also where we have most of our information on subsurface macropores. So that's kind of going to, this area is kind of going to be the focus of the talk here today. The purpose of this slide is to just kind of highlight these three basic rock types I already described. That is, a coarse clastic component, a fine clastic component, and a carbonate rock component. Through a number of cores spread out across much of southeastern Minnesota that have been plugged and tested in laboratories for permeability, we've got a real good handle on the matrix or intergranular properties of these three rock types, the carbonate, fine clastic, and coarse clastic. And the way it falls out is the coarse clastic matrix permeability is typically 1 to 30 feet per day. The fine clastic matrix permeability is about 10 to the minus 4th feet per day, and the carbonate is about the same or even much lower. So in essence, what you have in terms of matrix conductivity is you've got one unit, the coarse clastic friable sandstone, that has a high porosity or high permeability, and you've got two units that have relatively low permeability. Now, what I'm going to do here, moving to the bottom, is just translate that information and turn it into a definition or a framework of aquifers and aquitards based entirely on the matrix properties here. That is, as you'd expect, the coarse clastic material with a conductivity of 1 to 30 feet per day becomes one of our sandstone aquifers. The fine clastic material with the low matrix conductivity, as well as the carbonate material with low matrix conductivity, becomes aquitards. All right? This is all, everything you're looking at there in the bottom slide is based entirely on matrix or intergranular attributes. And you could leave it at this, and life would be simple, right? At least, I think, to most hydrogeologists, if that's all we had to worry about, because really we have these matrix components mapped out in fairly great detail across all of southeastern Minnesota. Bruce Blumgren mentioned the gamma logs. We've got over 6,000 gamma logs in the Paleozoic rocks of southeastern Minnesota. Those gamma logs reflect these different rock types, and therefore we can truly map out these variations in porosity and permeability. So we've really got this part nailed. But unfortunately, and as all of you know, is that it's much more complicated than that, because matrix conductivity or matrix porosity and permeability isn't the only kind of porosity in these rocks. Instead, you've also got macropores like we're looking at here. So this kind of begins really the meat of the talk in terms of what I'm going to say in the next 20 or 30 slides. And the way I'm going to do it or organize this talk is I'm going to first talk about bedding plane fractures, which are shown down here, and then I'm going to talk about vertical fractures. First, I want to just say a few things about what these terms mean, the terms vertical fractures and bedding plane fractures. You notice with the term vertical fractures, I put quotes around it. The quotes are there because what I'm doing for the purposes of today's talk is lumping any subvertical fracture along with true vertical fractures or fractures that are truly perpendicular to bedding planes all into one group. I'm not going to break out what we've broken out before in terms of fractures like this, where we call these non-systematic fractures. Okay? Unlike the flat-sided joints that have this orthogonal pattern, non-systematic fractures are probably more of a stress release phenomena. But again, for the purpose of this talk, anything that's roughly or close to perpendicular to bedding is going to be vertical fractures. With the bedding plane fractures, here I've actually added quotes on the fractures part of the label here. And the reason that is no one can really agree as to whether these bedding plane fractures are truly fractures in the sense that a structural geologist defines a fracture. I may talk about that a little bit more later. So again, for the purposes of our talk, all I mean here with bedding plane fractures and VUGs are a series of openings that are concordant with bedding and seem to follow predictable stratigraphic positions. Okay, those are bedding plane fractures. Other people prefer to call them bedding plane partings. All right, how are we going to do this? How have we, you know, we've been working on characterizing secondary porosity or macropores in the Paleozoic bedrock of southeastern Minnesota for, you know, intensely for about 15 years now. And what I'm trying to show here in this illustration are the different kinds of data that have proven useful for making this characterization. What I'm going to talk about mostly today, what I separate out here with regard to these data is in the upper part we've got what we call key hydrostratigraphic data. And these are the data that simply help us locate macropores without regard to water properties. That is, we're just trying to locate the holes in the rock. And with regard to the hydrostrat data, what we're going to focus on today are video logs and outcrop observations. Okay? With regard to hydraulic data, which we keep separate from the hydrostratigraphic data, the hydraulic data consist only of measurements of flow in the rocks. Okay, examples of those would be, for instance, standard pump tests, specific capacity conductivity, dye traces, in particular for this talk, EM flow meter logs. And what we try to do as much as possible in our analysis of and formulation of an overall hydrogeologic framework is that we map the holes in the rock, then we collect the water flow measurements and interpret the water measurements within the context of the hydrostratigraphic framework. Okay, we try to keep those separate. However, you will find towards the tail end of this talk that we violate that principle when we start getting into the vertical fractures and starting to characterize vertical fractures. And I'll explain what I mean when I get to that part of the talk. The last thing I want to point out here is we just did a compilation yesterday on with regard to how many flow logs we've collected over the last 10 years or so. And the flow logs, the electromagnetic flow logs, were up to just over 100 flow logs now, scattered across a pretty wide area, mostly concentrated in the Twin Cities metro area, but scattered across much of southeastern Minnesota. And I'm going to show you some examples of those in just a minute here. Okay, as I said, part one, bedding plane fractures. That's what I'm going to key on here, mostly using flow logs. What this is just supposed to remind you of are some of the examples of bedding plane fractures, all outcrop examples in this case. A typical bedding plane fracture with a spring emitted from it in the upper part of the Platteville Formation in Hennepin County, a bedding plane fracture in the St. Lawrence Formation, which is mostly very fine-grained sandstone, siltstone, and shale. It's actually classified as an aquitard in Minnesota, and I'll talk more about that later with regard to high conductivity intervals within aquitards. Here is a bedding plane fracture spring in coarse clastic material near Stillwater, Minnesota, in the Franconia Formation. And here is a bedding plane fracture, kind of a fossil one in the sense that I don't think there's been any water out of it for many years, in the lower part of the Jordan Sandstone. So this spectrum right here shows you an example of really the ubiquitousness, the consistency in which these bedding plane fractures occur in all different rock types. The rock type doesn't seem to matter. They're not restricted to carbonate rocks only. All right, and this one you could probably consider the king of all bedding plane fracture systems. And here, too, some stratigraphic control with a contact here between the Oneota Dolomite and the overlying Shakopee Formation and a system of very large macropores following along that contact. This is Bob tipping for scale here, so you can get an idea of the size of this. All right, and we're going to return to many of these examples and link them to subsurface information. What you're going to see now in the next three slides are examples separated by rock type of what are we consider to be representative flow meter logs that document flow, significant flow, through bedding plane fractures. And these two flow meter logs here, what we're starting with is bedding plane fracture flow in friable coarse sandstone units. And I'm going to spend, with this first flow log, the one on top only, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it, just so you can all, for those of you who haven't been exposed to flow logs before, so you can get at least a general sense of what kind of data we're pulling out of these flow logs and how we interpret them. This is a hole in Rice County. It was a strat test hole for the city of Webster. The first thing we do when we go into one of these holes is we collect a natural gamma log. This natural gamma log, along with what's below it and above it, tells us the open hole interval exposes almost all of the Jordan sandstone here. Okay? Then we run a caliper log, which gives us hole diameter. Sometimes they're quite useful for locating fractures in sandstones. Often they're not so useful because the bedding plane fractures typically have fairly small apertures. Then we ran a video log, which was actually much more useful for locating bedding plane fractures than the caliper log. These black squiggly lines, each of them denote a position we saw in the video log of a bedding plane fracture. And then what was also cool about this particular hole, and the reason it's included in this talk, is that there was turbulent flow associated in ambient conditions, turbulent flow associated with two of the bedding plane fractures, one down here and turbulent flow up here. And we have a movie, actually, of this particular turbulent flow, and it's shaped just like it's shown here. That is, it's shaped that way in a vortex because the flow is strong enough and in a vortex shape, and the vortex can be made out because suspended in the vortex are coarse grains of sand. So that's how strong the flow is. And so we had seen all that in the video. The next step in a typical flow log hole is we go in with our flow meter and pray that we don't get it stuck at the bottom of the hole, which has happened about six times now, I guess, at $17,000 a crack. In this particular hole, before we got the tool stuck, I'll show you, that's the truth. I'll show you what we measured. In the green, that's an indication of ambient flow, the green line here. What we see here is that this bedding plane fracture with the turbulent flow we saw in the video, water exits that fracture at a rate that we can measure. We never capture all the flow, so these would be minimum flows at a rate of about, it's hard from my angle, but a rate of about, let's say, 4 liters a minute travels up the hole and then abruptly exits at the bedding plane fracture higher in the section where we also saw turbulent flow, all right? So a fairly simple system, but already telling us something important. That is, in both cases, the bedding plane fractures are within coarse-grained friable sandstone, here and here, okay? And the hydraulic conductivity is sufficient to at least allow, you know, liters per minute to come out of to be emitted from this bedding plane fracture and to exit the hole at that bedding plane fracture. What we did next then is we brought in a water truck and injected the hole at a rate of, I'd have to check my notes, but 5 to 10 gallons a minute, and then also measured flow in the hole, and that's what this red line depicts. Again, we don't capture all the flow. What we're capturing here is close to 10 liters a minute, not 10 gallons a minute, coming down the borehole, bypassing all this good, clean, highly porous Jordan sandstone, bypassing this hydraulic conduit here, and all the injected water exiting at this bedding plane fracture at the bottom. Because we knew our injection rate, we know the head change while we inject, we're documenting that as well, we can come up with a hydraulic conductivity for that bedding plane fracture, and it comes out to be 12,500 feet per day. All right? And I put this note here, typical logs, greater than 90% fracture flow, K, hundreds to thousands of feet per day. Without exaggerating, we could come up with another dozen or two logs like this of in coarse clastic sandstone where we get similar results, where decays are hundreds to thousands of feet per day. Now I'm going to do with the next five flow logs, I am going to whip through them because a lot of it's the same concepts. I just want to demonstrate to you that this isn't a unique situation, and not unique to the Jordan sandstone and not unique in location, all right? So I'll just give you some more examples. This particular example is Washington County, which is the eastern metro area. We did a study for the health department and the PCA at one of the perfluorochemical contamination sites, ended up logging a lot of St. Peter sandstone holes. The log I want to point out here is an injection log. It's in red, an injection log where we injected water, again, somewhere between 5 and 10 gallons a minute. It exits abruptly at a bedding plane fracture that's pictured right here, and exits at a lower bedding plane fracture here and another here. Again, we know the injection rate, we know the head change, and we calculate K values of 10,000 feet per day for the upper one, 2,500 and 708 feet per day for the lower bedding plane fracture. All of these, again, importantly, are within coarse grain friable sandstone or near the contacts or on the contacts between friable sandstone and the fine clastic material. There we go. Now we're moving into carbonate rock units. Just two quick examples. I'm going to run through them fairly fast again because I've gone through the concepts of the flow meter logging. These things show a few different things that I'll have to point out. Otherwise, this should go pretty rapidly. Documenting bedding plane flow in carbonate units. The top example is a flow log in the Prairie du Chien formation. Point out here, we didn't have a video log, but in the Prairie du Chien, what you often can get because the macro pores are so large is you do get distinct kicks on the caliper logs where there are bedding plane fractures. All right, we didn't inject this hole. This is ambient conditions, and what it shows will actually start from the bottom is that you get water entering the hole probably in intergranular fashion in the upper part of the Jordan here. A kick here that we believe is fracture flow entry that corresponds to the bedding plane here in the upper part of the Jordan. Then consistent upflow through the hole, and then water loss at about the mid Prairie du Chien position here, the contact between the Shakopee and the Oneota. So a higher head here, water moving up the hole, and exiting at a bedding plane fracture with a lower head. What's kind of cool about this log, and it's not unique, we have others like this, you have another system, if you will, where water is entering the hole here, moving down through a bedding plane fracture, moving down the hole, and then exiting at a lower bedding plane fracture right here. So you've got an interesting head distribution there. Again, to drive any of this in a vertical bore hole, what you need are two or more permeable intervals, and then you have to have a difference in head. It's as simple as that. So you just have to work that through to explain a pattern like that. So that's the Prairie du Chien, the example on the bottom, a very simple example. This is work we just started this fall. I'm going to talk more about it later on in about 10 or 20 minutes here, on the Platteville Formation. We've got a Platteville monitor well here, really nice simple kick showing us where there's a nice bedding plane fracture here in the Platteville. We injected the well at about 5 or 6 gallons a minute. All the measurable injected water leaves at one single discrete bedding plane fracture. Okay, very typical flow log. All right, and I'll finish up for individual flow logs with bedding plane fracture flow in fine clastic units. Okay, and this, to me, this becomes a little more interesting because we're moving into the realm of documenting bedding plane fracture flow in the units that are regarded as aquitards. Okay, so in a way, to some degree, this is kind of new territory. I'm going to start here with the St. Lawrence example up here at the top. All ambient flow here. We've got, you know, as you'd expect, no flow in the casing, and then just below the casing, there's a bedding plane fracture, all right, through which a pretty slow rate, now we're in gallons a minute. I know these things move around from liters to gallon, from slide to slide, but I didn't have time to convert them all to one unit. In any case, we're moving to maybe a tenth of a gallon a minute is emitted from this bedding plane fracture, and then it staggers its way out the hole through lower bedding plane fractures in the setting, in the section. At the bottom, we have an example of the Franconia Formation, as well as the Yerington-Galesville. Again, ambient flow. We'll start at the bottom with this one. We've got water that's, no, we'll start at the top at this one, since it's downflow. We've got water entering the hole, kind of in the middle of the Franconia Formation at a distinct bedding plane fracture. You can see it right here. I don't know if you can make it out on the photograph here, but here too there are suspended sand grains. The water that was exiting that particular bedding plane fracture in this hole was at times kind of in pulses blowing out fine to medium quartz grains out of that hole. And that's what you're seeing there, some of the light dots behind that, within that fracture. So anyway, the water is emitted into the borehole at that bedding plane fracture, travels down the hole at a fairly high rate. It looks like we're looking at about 15 liters per minute, and then exits in a more gradual fashion, like this. And I included this particular flow log in part just so I could demonstrate to you that it is possible for us to recognize intergranular flow in these logs. There's not a bias against recognizing intergranular flow. What we like to see is a lot of measurements along that indicate some kind of consistent slope. And this is what you'd expect for the Yerington-Galesville sandstone, as opposed to a fine clastic unit, which has a high porosity and permeability. All right, what I'm gonna do in about 5 or 10 minutes is link those individual flow logs I just showed you into a series of correlated flow logs. And what I'm gonna try to get at with regard to that is to show that it's not just a random distribution of wells that we've logged with no predictable pattern in terms of where the bedding plane fractures occur. Instead, through correlation of the flow logs, we can come up with some degree of predictability. But until I do that, I want to take a little sidetrack here into the discussion of what these bedding plane fractures mean in terms of, or what are their implications of having bedding plane fractures in aquitards. And we're going to do this looking at the St. Lawrence Formation. What I want to start with on this diagram is show you some information. This is just one place you could get this kind of information. It's at the 80 site, the Aquifer Thermal Energy Storage Site on the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota, where they tested in great detail a significant part of the Cambrian section. And for the St. Lawrence Formation, what they came up with is that, as you'd expect, it's fine clastic material with minor carbonate. It has a matrix conductivity of about 10 to the minus 4 feet per day or less. Okay, that's based on plug samples. It has a bulk vertical conductivity measured at less than 10 to the minus 4 feet per day. And at this site and in other places in southeastern Minnesota, at least locally, you can document that the heads above the St. Lawrence differ significantly, or at least measurably, from the heads below the St. Lawrence. Well, you put all that together, and I think virtually anyone's conclusion would be that's a perfectly good aquitard. And therefore, it makes perfectly good sense that, for instance, the health department considers it an aquitard that shouldn't be exposed in open hole intervals and that kind of thing. It's regulated as an aquitard. But then you run into problems, or at least you run into complications. I already showed you a flow log that had ambient flow traveling in and out of the St. Lawrence Formation. We did a project that we finished about 3 years ago for the health department, in which we looked at and got into as many boreholes as we could of the St. Lawrence Formation to just try to get a handle of this bedding plane fracture flow. And what we saw summarized here is that bedding plane fractures in the St. Lawrence aquitard are present regionally, and that ambient flow through at least one bedding plane fracture was measured in 14 of the 17 tested boreholes. You combine that, in my view, if you combine that is, when I say that, I mean all the subsurface information, with what we see along the St. Croix River, also in the metro area, really from Chisago County all the way down into Washington, which is very common St. Lawrence Formation springs, I think the best way to characterize the St. Lawrence Formation is that it may be vertically resistant to flow, but in a horizontal direction, it's characterized by a network of bedding plane fractures with moderate to even high conductivity. Some of the ambient flow in these wells is measured in gallons per minute, by the way. Well, let's look at it another way. Within the last year, I believe it was this summer, Jeff Green and Andrew Peters and Calvin Alexander and Andrew Lumen have been working a great deal down in Fillmore, Winona, Houston counties on a springshed mapping project. And as part of that, Jeff Green and Andrew have been conducting at least one, and I think they're on their second, St. Lawrence diatreds. Jeff Green has recognized disappearing streams or losing streams into the St. Lawrence Formation. And one such diatrace that has been completed is the Ehrensfeld diatrace. This map shows the die input point, and these are the springs that were monitored for die output. This stratigraphic column and this block diagram in cartoon fashion show the results. The die input was at the very top of the St. Lawrence. The die where it was detected at the springs down gradient was at the very bottom of the St. Lawrence, or very close to the very bottom of the St. Lawrence. Based on their results, what they calculated was a horizontal flow speed in hundreds of meters per day. This is through an aquitard, okay? And a vertical flow speed, if you will, that is just the vertical distance it took the die to kind of, we assume, stair-step its way down to full penetration of the St. Lawrence Formation was measured in meters per day. Okay, so far I've talked about, you know, I started by showing you an illustration that indicates using conventional measurements, the St. Lawrence makes a very good aquitard, but if you consider the bedding plane fracture systems, it behaves a lot more like a classic aquifer, albeit a fracture-dominated aquifer. You look at this diatrace, and it doesn't look like it has much aquitard integrity based on this diatrace. And what I'll finish with here is a pretty simple slide, or at least with pretty simple data. What this slide is showing is a comparison based on CWI data. It is specific capacity data converted to hydraulic conductivity, comparing in deep bedrock conditions, that means buried by 50 feet or more of overlying bedrock, comparing the Ironton-Galesville aquifer to the St. Lawrence aquitard to the upper Franconia aquifer. And here's how the comparison plays out. The Ironton-Galesville in deep conditions averages in hydraulic conductivity 10.8 feet per day, the St. Lawrence 18.4 feet per day, and the upper Franconia 16.1 feet per day. That's an acknowledged aquifer. That's an acknowledged aquifer. This is treated as an aquitard. Now, what you have to do next is start thinking. There's a lot of different definitions out there of aquifers and aquitards. Use any one you want and then try to answer these questions. And I'm not going to give an answer. Is the St. Lawrence Formation an aquifer? Is the St. Lawrence Formation an aquitard? Or is the St. Lawrence Formation an aquitardifer? See, I knew people would laugh. You know, I've tried to insert a joke in this, like, before you can laugh and say, I have this copyrighted. So any of you can use this if you pay me a nickel, use that term. But the fact that everybody laughs at it, I think my copyright is, I don't know why I copyrighted it. I don't think anybody's ever going to use it. I am 10% serious about it. And I think if you really think hard about the regulatory implications of what's going on with the St. Lawrence, and I don't think the St. Lawrence is unique. I think this is an issue that'll appear with many of our other aquitards. I'll just leave it at that. And I guess what I'll finish with, I don't want to go through a terminology discussion or a nomenclature discussion, but think about this. At least it's my belief that the definitions of aquifer and aquitard are not mutually exclusive, and that's part of the problem here. All right, I did promise, I don't know how that happened, I did promise I'd try to correlate individual flow logs to take these things to greater distances. And I'm going to have to whip through some of these. I am getting behind a little bit, although I think we did start late. First off, here we are in the Lake Elmo area, and we're in the lower St. Peter sandstone at the top and the upper part of the Shakopee Formation at the bottom. We went in here at the request of the Health Department and the PCA to get a better handle on how the PFC contaminants were traveling across this part of the stratigraphic section. This is a fairly small area compared to what I'm going to show you later, maybe 1 square mile where we did this flow logging. This is a very simple diagram that is only supposed to highlight the individual flow logs we collected from 16 wells in the study area. And all you're supposed to look at here is sharp deflections. Just like the examples I gave you before, if you get a sharp horizontal deflection, that's an indication of bedding flow along bedding plane fractures, either entering or exiting a well. The flow logs are hung on the contact, basically hung on the contact between Shakopee and the St. Peter sandstone, all right? Well, what do you see? I think at the very least what you can say about this site is that within this 1 square mile area, we've documented that fracture flow dominates, at least at the scale of our tests of injections at 5 or 10 gallons a minute, dominates the hydrologic system in the lower St. Peter sandstone. And another way to put it is, even with this nice friable coarse-grained St. Peter sandstone, in none of our injections led to a flow log that gave us a gradational exit of water. They were all abrupt exits like this, exiting out of bedding plane fractures. Many of the holes were video logged. We would find the bedding plane fractures corresponding to the proper spot. So we think we nailed it down pretty well. To take it a little further before I move on, if we did more logs, what we did have indicated to me that we might have started to see that bedding plane fractures themselves within the context of the lower St. Peter also preferentially develop at unit or facies contacts. For instance, the contact at the base of unit 2 and the contact at the top of unit 3 here. Those seem to be particular bed contacts where bedding plane fractures were preferentially developed. All right, now we're going to move up to a much bigger scale or across a much bigger area here. This is an old figure, but I really like it, in part because it's got the craziest cross-section line you've ever seen, which goes from the northern metro part, northern or up by Chisago County, and curls around here, skirting the western part of the Twin Cities Basin, and ends down here in Hastings. I couldn't think of a better way to do it because all the logs we got were just along that same arcuate path. Whatever, that doesn't really matter too much. What this is supposed to show is it's supposed to be a summary figure of all our flow logs in the Franconia and Ironton-Galesville. All right? What they show is, okay, you've got this cartoon cross-section. The Franconia formation is from here to here with the Ironton-Galesville on the bottom. These lines on the cross-section are places we've collected flow logs. These are the flow logs beneath each of those lines. What I want to do is just briefly summarize the results and the implications. In the Ironton-Galesville, not everywhere, but more often than not, we got a gradually sloping line, indicating that flow was intergranular. This would be one of the exceptions. Everywhere in the upper Franconia, but not in the lower, we often also saw water exiting or entering the hole, and with these abrupt inflections indicating flow through bedding plane fractures. You plot all those, or you put a bedding plane fracture at each of those inflections onto the cross section, and what you end up seeing is an intergranular aquifer down here, a middle portion of the Franconia formation with few, if any, bedding plane fractures except near incised valleys, and then an upper one half of the Franconia formation that's riddled with, or at least has a high density cluster of bedding plane fractures. This is what I'm getting at with regard to predictability. We're not at the level we can follow one bedding plane fracture across tens of miles, but I think we can subdivide units into parts of units or certain horizons that have abundant bedding plane fractures versus certain horizons that have few or no bedding plane fractures. All right, finishing up here with, well, this won't be quite finishing up. Moving on to the Prairie du Chien. I showed you this picture earlier with Bob Tipping standing next to these huge holes, which when Todd Kincaid gave his talk, I was thinking, you know, this conduit system is large enough, and I'll show you in a minute, extensive enough across southeast Minnesota. You got to take a shot at seeing how far into away from the Mississippi River into central Minnesota you could get through these holes. They are very big and very well connected. So what we see in outcrop here and in plan view here, based on our subsurface data, seems to also be present across virtually all of southeastern Minnesota. What I mean by that is I'll use an example here with a caliper log. Caliper log kick in this direction is just simply indicating a wider borehole. Okay, it's hitting, a kick like this would correspond to a large open cavity like that. In comparing these calipers across all of southeastern Minnesota, what we commonly see is our few kicks and relatively small kicks in the lower part of the Oneota, many more kicks in the Shakopee Formation, that is, many more holes in the Shakopee Formation, and then a mid-Prairie du Chien that roughly corresponds to the Oneota-Shakopee contact, where you consistently, almost in every hole, get very large macro pores. On top of that, if we combine all the information Calvin and Scott Alexander, Jeff Green, have collected on dye traces in the Prairie du Chien, you look at our flow logs. I'm not going to give it specific examples here. Flow logs where we've seen flow entering and exiting along this same level. Video logs all indicate that this is a significant conduit system that can be traced from the northern metro area all the way nearly to the Iowa border and east to Winona. All right, and now I'm going to move actually down to really small scale, really site-specific scale, because there's a reason to bring the Platteville, a couple different reasons to bring the Platteville Formation into this again. If any of you know Kelton Barr or seen any of his talks, you're going to see one today, and I bet he mentions this at his talk today. He has for years told me about seeing a stratigraphic spring link around the Twin Cities metro area. What I mean by that is a common position, very common position for high capacity springs seems to be right at the top of what's called the Hidden Falls member of the Platteville Formation, or the contact of the Magnolia member with the Hidden Falls. In an effort to pursue that, in the subsurface, what we've begun doing is flow logging University of Minnesota monitor wells. We've only got about five of them now. We're going across distance of only about half the campus here. And what's really remarkable here are the results, I think, compared to other kinds of flow logs where we are identifying kind of stratigraphic clusters of bedding plane fractures. Is that the injected water in all five of the holes that we've logged is exiting the hole within either directly on or within a foot of the Hidden Falls Magnolia contact. All right? It's an example of just what I think is really remarkable stratigraphic control on a secondary porosity feature. And again, I've talked several times here today about predictability and the value of predictability. And anytime we see this kind of stratigraphic, really tight stratigraphic control on macro pores, I think it tells us we can have, even at the scale, if we can link it with the springs, even at the scale of the Platteville Formation across the entire metro area, we can predict, you know, plus or minus a few feet where a major conduit system may lie in the subsurface. All right, I'm going to summarize bedding plane fractures here. Using a basic stratigraphic column of all the Paleozoic rocks of southeastern Minnesota, I'm going to add to this progressively here. What it shows right now in brackets is the part of the stratigraphic section where we've collected a lot, the 100 flow logs I just mentioned. Okay, we've been focused mostly in the metro area and mostly in the most widely used aquifers, and for that reason, we've worked mostly between the Eau Claire Formation on the bottom and the Platteville Formation on top. Based on those 100 flow logs, we feel fairly confident in placing or indicating that these specific stratigraphic intervals are intervals that have preferential development of hydraulically active bedding plane fractures. The mid Prairie du Chien one would be shown here. The upper Franconia cluster would be shown here as examples. And the one between within the Platteville at the top of the Hidden Falls and below the Magnolia would be shown here. What I also think is that as we continue to do this, we've had enough success so far, as we continue to do this and get in more holes, and particularly if we can get ourselves out of the metro area and get our way up into the higher part of the stratigraphic section, we're going to see the same kind of link. That is, we're going to see preferential development of bedding plane fractures at specific and predictable stratigraphic intervals. And last, I think when people like Kelvin and Jeff Green and Andrew Luman and Andrew Peters finish up, for instance, with their springshed mapping work that they're working so hard on now across southeastern Minnesota, we're also going to be able to make a link between the occurrence of sinks and spring holes and stratigraphic position. And in many instances, I believe the position of sinks and springs and sinkholes will correspond to the intervals that in the subsurface we see as having preferential development of secondary porosity. So there's going to be this, I think we're going to arrive at this link between springs and sinks, which essentially are surface water features, and then the deeper subsurface, linking it to the deeper subsurface, all held together by the stratigraphy. And I think that's going to be very useful. All right, part two, vertical fractures. This is the part, and this is practically the same exact slide with a couple different additions that I used to finish the talk 2 years ago and said, look at, there's a fracture in an aquitard. You can get fractures in outcrop in an aquitard. Here's a fracture in a coarse sandstone in a borehole, very deep, but the well was blasted and bailed, so it doesn't really count. But it does tell you the plane of weaknesses in that hole. Same thing here. Just basically made the point that vertical fractures are everywhere in outcrop. They're probably in the subsurface, but because vertical boreholes don't commonly intersect vertical fractures, we don't have a lot more to say about it. We did add that there are a number of studies around the world, or at least in stratified sedimentary rocks, that do indicate, such as this really nice study in Wisconsin, that vertical fracture connectivity, aperture size, and linear trace will typically diminish with depth, so that there's this notion of shallow bedrock conditions versus deeper bedrock conditions. And we have been able to show in various ways that that seems to hold up in Minnesota. And these two examples are new compared to what I showed a couple of years ago. Kelton Barr was nice enough to loan me this slide for this talk. It is the excavation underneath the Anderson Library on the University of Minnesota campus. And what it's a good example of is that you see these darker black lines. They represent places where pans were put up on the ceiling to catch water dripping from Platteville joints. Okay, they're underneath the Platteville here. And the ceiling of the Platteville, the bottom of the Platteville, the ceiling of the library, has joints everywhere across it. But the point is the joints are relatively open and open enough to leak water near the bluff edge. But as you get progressively away from the bedrock surface, the joints close and don't leak any water. Just this week, 2 days ago, Julia Anderson, co-author of this talk, her and I were lucky enough to get a tour of a frac sand mine in the Jordan Sandstone in Wisconsin, where we were able to go into a sandstone aquifer through hundreds of meters of tunnels, 200 feet beneath the land surface. So it was a rare opportunity to actually see a sandstone aquifer up close, exposed in three dimensions. And what we noticed and really had anticipated seeing is that all the vertical fractures you see in outcrop, like this one, St. Lawrence, but a vertical fracture like that, you do see in the subsurface, even where there's 300 feet of younger bedrock on top. But what the major difference between the two areas is, the subsurface versus the surface, is we saw virtually no joints that you could stick your finger in, let alone even stick a piece of paper in. The joints are virtually closed. The fracture lengths or terminations did seem to, the linear traces did generally seem shorter, but at the same time, we saw many joint sets that extended for many tens of feet up through a section and across the ceiling. So we didn't get as good a handle on that. All right. So that's where I left it last time, and now it's time to just really do some more, draw in other people's work, I guess, and see how well we can apply it to the rocks here in Minnesota. And really, admittedly, this is going to get a little more arm wavy than, say, the bedding plane fracture part of the talk, where I think we have things really tightly documented. We're going to start with a study by Chad Underwood. Chad Underwood was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They have great hydro people there who have for a long time been interested in the Paleozoic hydrogeologic system of that part of Wisconsin around Madison. They were into the bedding plane fracture scene long before we were. They trained us essentially how to recognize bedding plane fractures using EM flow meter logs and things like that. So they've always been a year or two ahead of us. We can't seem to catch up. And in keeping with that same kind of plan, being a year or two ahead of us, they had been sending out people like Chad Underwood to just look at fractures in outcrops. In this particular case, to look at vertical fracture terminations, to look at the mechanical stratigraphy, to see if by mapping vertical fracture terminations, they could get any hint as to how bedding plane fracture systems are developed and then get a better idea of predicting bedding plane fracture system. They were also interested in the implications of vertical fracture terminations with regard to aquitard integrity. And I'm going to talk about both of those things here. The key thing to notice on this slide, on this particular illustration, is that in mapping these terminations, there's one particular bed here shaded gray through which, or that seems to be resistant, relatively resistant compared to other beds to through-going vertical fractures. Okay? And I brought it over to there. We're going to see that on the next slide right here. Okay? And one thing they suggested that is if there's a particular bed in a succession of strata that's resistant to the propagation of vertical fractures, vertical flow through fractures will be possibly redirected horizontally, which is going to promote horizontal dissolution along that interface. Okay, so they made the link in kind of an arm-wavy fashion. The gist of the paper was just to try to get an idea statistically if particular beds were resistant, more resistant to others for through-going fractures. So the vertical water, or the water moving vertically, is redirected horizontally. It promotes dissolution, and voila, that's how you get your bedding plane conduits like the Platteville Formation. So we've just now, in the last few weeks, gone out to some outcrops, some Platteville outcrops, taking a look at them, taking a look at vertical fracture patterns and where those vertical fractures terminate. In this case, at the Magnolia Hidden Falls contact, you can see vertical fracture that terminates, that doesn't extend down to the Hidden Falls. Same thing here, vertical fracture doesn't extend down to the Hidden Falls. And then, of course, you always have troublemakers like this one here, which is kind of oblique and difficult to see, but there is a vertical fracture here that penetrates fully through both the lower part of the Magnolia and the upper Hidden Falls. But that's, in a way, that may not matter. What they're really looking for are beds where the lowest percentage of through-going vertical fractures. As to why you get the vertical fracture terminations here, what you're typically looking for is a ductal bed at the mechanical interface. So you've got a mechanical unit here and a mechanical unit here. You have a ductal bed here. That'll promote termination of vertical fractures. If there's no shale, what they look for is just a weak interface, which really can't be identified in the field. In this case, it's kind of a simple scenario in the Platteville Formation. This is one of the few legitimate, well-developed, even though it's only about centimeter scale, shale siltstone beds in the Platteville Formation. So it would make sense that vertical fractures terminate at this spot. The last thing I'll say about this is I don't claim to be a fluid flow expert, so I can't argue against their kind of arm-wavy model of redirecting vertical flow horizontally to create these bedding plane fractures. But what they didn't throw out there, and I can't say that this isn't a viable option, what if the bedding plane fractures actually are first and the vertical fractures are second? All right. These rocks certainly could have begun dissolving very shortly after deposition, even 450 million years ago. Maybe at intervals like this, this part of the Platteville was more aragonitic than higher or lower in the section, and therefore dissolved more easily, therefore giving you a bedding plane conduit system. The vertical fractures come in later, and of course, if you want a weak interface, what better weak interface to have than a big hole in the rock, centimeter-sized hole in the rock. So it's kind of a chicken and an egg problem here. I don't think it's really sorted out, but I still think it's interesting to try to come up with a conceptual model that links vertical fractures with the bedding plane fractures. Moving along with the same topic, the potential link to stratigraphic position and origin of bedding plane fractures with the vertical fractures. Here I'm moving into the siliciclastics here. What we went out and looked at a couple weeks ago was the lower one half of the Jordan sandstone. Here you see a nice vertical joint in the Jordan sandstone. Importantly, what you also see is that it terminates down here in the lower 10 feet or so of Jordan sandstone. All right. You can walk this outcrop for about 200 meters, come up with a couple dozen of these joints looking virtually identical to one another in azimuth and the size of the aperture. Every one of them terminates down here in these lower Jordan beds. Again, making the link, the potential link to bedding plane fractures, what you also see then when you walk laterally down this outcrop is that these beds at which the vertical fractures terminate also have preferential development of bedding plane fractures. Now, does this fit with the same model that Chad Underwood suggested? That is, redirecting vertical flow horizontally and then dissolving out or by promoting horizontal flow preferentially at the base of these fracture terminations, you're in essence making a solution conduit. Personally, I don't think that fits here at all. I don't think these are solution features in the sandstones. I think there's something else. I think they're more mechanical removal of sand grains. And I'm not going to go into it in detail, but you see how the strata are actually deformed here and here, right along this bedding plane conduit? That's soft sediment deformation. What we think now, and we've got a student from Carleton College working on this, is that there was a major, perhaps regional scale fluid event, one or more, in which many of the bedding plane conduit systems were created very early on, after deposition of the Jordan sandstone, but before compaction and lithification. So these may be very old bedding plane conduit systems. Okay, the last topic I want to talk about is vertical fracture terminations, implications for aquitards. And I'll see if I can muck my way through this. This Wisconsin work, which I think is excellent, some of it I only got my hands on or only closely read in the last week or so in an effort to do some arm waving on the vertical fractures for this talk. This summarizes some work by a fellow named Tim Eaton. And what he looked at was the Maquoketa aquitard in southeastern Wisconsin, which is a very, very important aquitard in southeastern Wisconsin. The nomenclature here is lumped a little bit. Everything below the Maquoketa is considered the Cambrian Ordovician aquifer in that part of the state, at least at the scale of what he's worried about here. Above the Maquoketa aquifer, you've got the Silurian Dolostone aquifer. All right, Tim was after a number of things here. All right, he knew it was an important aquitard because there was a dramatic change in head above and below it. In other words, the Silurian Dolostone aquifer has a head of about 260 meters. And it's a full 60 meters lower in the Canberra Ordovician aquifer. That's due to pumping over the last many decades. The pumping has diminished the level in the Canberra Ordovician aquifer by about 130 meters, I believe. He wanted to investigate what this Maquoketa aquitard was all about and whether there, in response to this pumping, any of the heads or in any other manner, that there's been any kind of response in the Maquoketa aquitard. So he put in a lot of multi-port systems. He did a lot of Packer tests, and he found some interesting things. For one thing, he found that at least the upper half of the Maquoketa aquitard was dominated by bedding plane fractures that had relatively high horizontal conductivity. Does that sound familiar? It's the same kind of thing you saw in the St. Lawrence Formation. All right, so I won't spend any time on that, but it is interesting that it's consistent. What he expected to see in the head profiles, he told me, was some kind of stepped or gradual change from here down to the level of what you see in the camera or revision aquifer. Instead, what surprised him is he gets this head profile, which is almost vertical all the way down to this level, very near the bottom of the Maquoketa aquitard, and an abrupt change of 60 meters in head across this discrete part of the lower shale part of the Maquoketa aquifer. What Tim suggested, but didn't pursue, was that an explanation for what he's seen in this abrupt head change from here to here is something analogous with regard to vertical fractures, analogous to what Chad Underwood documented in this quarry. That is, it's a ductal shale in the lower part of the Maquoketa that in essence provides all the aquitard integrity you need to maintain a 60 meter head difference above and below the Maquoketa Kingly and Ordovician aquifer contact. All right, shortly after that, a group from Waterloo headed to south central Wisconsin and looked at some units that, at least for me, are more familiar, from the Prairie du Chien down to the Mount Simon. And do you see a common theme here, by the way, where I started talking about, right after I started talking about vertical fractures, it was northeastern Wisconsin, southeastern Wisconsin, south central Wisconsin. We are legitimately riding the coattails of the Madison group and their colleagues from out of town here. I'm not ashamed of that. I just want to make sure they get some credit for it. In south central Wisconsin at a contamination site, I realize I'm running over a little bit. I only have about three more slides, so we should, or three or four, so I should be able to finish up pretty soon here. They put in a multi-port system that allowed them to measure at about, on average, 1 meter intervals, heads across the stratigraphic section that goes from the Prairie du Chien all the way down to the Mount Simon. What's interesting here, at least for the purposes of this talk, is similar to what Tim Eaton saw, there were distinct inflections, this probably being the best example, distinct inflections in head between aquifer boundaries. What they also did at this site is they did discrete interval packer tests. They did a number of flow logs and other borehole geophysical measurements, including acoustic televiewer to get an idea of fracture patterns and things like that. In summary, the way they characterized the system, putting all that information together along with these head data, is that they characterized the system as being a stacked, mostly fracture flow aquifer system with limited vertical fracture connection between adjacent aquifer units. Importantly, they said, there are no aquitards in the conventional sense, with the exception, and I didn't add this in the text here, with the exception of one narrow interval of the lower part of the Eau Claire Formation. So the way they're describing it, and these are our rocks. I know this is south central Wisconsin, but these are our rocks too. I've seen these cores. And they're not fundamentally different in any way that I could see visually from what we have here in parts of Minnesota. And what they're calling it is a system of stacked fracture flow aquifers, with the aquitards just being essentially unfractured intervals, separating the fractured aquitards. So to explore this conceptual model that's described here, they ran a 2D Fractran model. Basically in a way where they limited the connectivity of vertical fractures in discrete intervals like you see here, here, and here, put in steady-state heads that were comparable to what they saw at the contamination site, ran the model, and the model plotted head profiles that pretty much mimicked what they see here in the real world with their multi-port head measurements. And they used the model results to just say, the numerical model supports the conceptual model, as much as you want to buy that. All right, but that intrigued me enough to go back to the Minnesota data. So let's step back and look. What I want to do here to finish up is look at the flow log information just a little bit more and try to use it in a different way. This is a log we collected at Northfield in the Prairie du Chien, Jordan, where we had upflow or water entering the hole out of the Jordan sandstone, flowing up the hole at a fairly high rate, about 30 or 40 liters a minute, and then it begins to exit here. What I want to point out specifically here is where I have this orange bar. This orange bar indicates, because of this flow pattern, that somewhere in this interval, the interval that separates inflow from outflow, there has to be at least one aquitard, one or more aquitard, or the whole interval is an aquitard. Well, at this particular hole, we also did packer tests where we could measure head levels, and what we found is that as we progressively lowered the packer, it wasn't until we reached this particular point that we got a large jump in head that was representative of the Jordan sandstone head. In other words, what we kept measuring was the water level above the packer and the water level below the packer. The water level below the packer jumps up right at this particular interval. We think that's analogous to the inflections you saw on Tim Eaton's head profiles and the inflections you saw on Jessica Meyer's work on the Cambrian Ordovician system in Wisconsin. So let's run with that, and let's say this is telling us the same thing it was telling the folks in Wisconsin, that is that there might be one discrete interval resistant to vertical fractures that serves as the key aquitard or provides the key aquitard integrity in that system. And how can we look at it then with more flow logs? Can we pin this down? Can we take that further from one site and look around the metro area and correlating flow logs, try to see if this holds up from place to place? What I've done here is I've plotted the Northfield flow log that I just went through, and then a number of others from the metro area. So we'd be heading from Northfield here up into the northern metro, wrapping around to Washington County. For each of these logs with an orange line, I've shown the quote cusp that separates inflow from outflow. So every one of those orange lines corresponds to a spot where there has to be at least one aquitard. You hang all the flow logs on the top of the Jordan sandstone and look for a stratigraphic position that is consistently passes through each of those orange lines. Okay? And we do have that marked here in red. What I'm saying here is that this is the stratigraphic position, the top of the Coon Valley, that based on these flow logs, potentially is a key aquitard that is resistant to vertical fractures. Well, the next thing we did then, just 2 weeks ago, is take a look at what we see in outcrop to see if that supports, if fracture patterns in outcrop support what we're hypothesizing based on the flow logs. These are some outcrops in Wabasha County. What you have here is Jordan sandstone, Coon Valley member of the Oneota, Hager City member of the Oneota. We took photographs at various angles, brought them back to the survey, put them up in Illustrator, and just started drawing lines along fracture traces. And what we see, at least at this angle, this is a very reconnaissance effort. It's going to take a lot more work than what we did to really be confident in this. But what we see at this angle, or this view of this outcrop, is that there is a specific stratigraphic interval here, right near or at the top of the Coon Valley, where vertical fractures preferentially terminate. And importantly, the fractures coming up from the Jordan also seem to terminate at the very same bed. Okay. And going back one more slide, that seems to be the same interval here that we tentatively identified as the aquifer.
It's the same stratigraphic position.
Second to the last slide here. Apologize for running late. All I've done here is kind of use the same methods I did for the Prairie du Chien group. That is, we've got, this time, hung a number of flow logs that were recorded across the lower Jordan, upper St. Lawrence part of the stratigraphic section hung the flow logs along the St. Lawrence-Jordan contact, stratigraphically correlated them that way, identified the cusp or turnaround from inflow to outflow for each of those logs, and tried to determine or check to see if there's a single stratigraphic position that passes through the cusp on each of those flow logs. Once again, it does. It indicates that approximately at the St. Lawrence-Jordan contact, there may be a bed that is resistant to through-going vertical fractures. Took that information into the field to look for the same kind of features we did with the lower part of the Prairie du Chien. In this case, the outcrops are a lot poorer. I think we can probably find some better ones. We couldn't find any we could actually photograph and then trace fracture terminations on. But we did see some kind of anecdotal evidence, or at least small outcrops that support this model of having some unit that's resistant to the penetration of vertical fractures. Many of the Jordan St. Lawrence springs in the area are at intersections of vertical joints that do not pass through the upper part of the St. Lawrence formation. Many of the very prominent vertical joints in the Jordan terminate before they reach the St. Lawrence. Again, both kind of supporting this conceptual model of having some stratigraphic position resistant to vertical fractures. I'm going to just skip that one and go to the final slide here. All right, I promised at the beginning of the talk that, or I didn't promise, but I suggested that we've collected enough information so far that I think we're close to being able to say we can map macro pores in the Paleozoic bedrock of southeastern Minnesota. Well, let's start with this. It's pretty well accepted now and well documented in Minnesota and elsewhere that there's a phenomenon that's called shallow bedrock conditions, and that's all I've added here. And that is, if you're within roughly 15 meters of the bedrock surface, fracture apertures are larger, fractures are more abundant, and there's better interconnection between the fractures. To me, that can be considered a given now. But it could be also considered here a map unit of sorts. Secondly, with our borehole flow meter logging, I think we're showing that the bedding plane fractures are abundant and they're also predictable. And the examples I gave you, for instance, are bedding plane fractures common in the upper Franconia formation as a mid-Prairie du Chien conduit in the lower part of the St. Peter through here, that kind of thing. The ones I've added lower here are ones that we maybe anticipate finding but don't yet have good evidence for. So this is a diagram I'm building up here towards. It's kind of my notion of what a depiction of the hydrogeologic system might be 10 years from now with more data. And last, with regard to vertical fractures, I think if we can demonstrate that there is some stratigraphic control, like the control I described to you here today on vertical fractures, that we can come up with some conceptual models of, in particular, models that will identify certain beds that are resistant to vertical fractures and could be designated with a label like super aquitards within otherwise, you know, more conductive in a vertical sense aquitard material. And I think I'll leave it at that. Answer questions if you have them. I'm not sure what you're asking, but are you asking perhaps through the drilling process, are they creating some kind of connectivity with existing vertical fractures except where they hit a ductal shale or something like that?
I'm not buying into the vertical fractures being the primary vertical transport mechanism. So my hypothesis is the other angle.
Okay.
Are they creating vertical fractures in more competent brittle rock?
Oh, I gotcha. Through the drilling process?
So in the process of doing the drill hole, basically, by creating the location to do your testing, are we creating the observation that we're creating?
Right. I guess it's worth looking into. I can't say that that's not true, that that's not happening.
Well, I don't know if that really puts any light on that question.
You're still asking about the drilling process? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, and that I can't shed any light on for you. I'd like to check into it. It hadn't occurred to me, to be honest with you. If the drilling process itself is altering the permeability in a way that, if I understand you correctly, what could have been a thicker, more competent aquitard is going to have the appearance of being much more discreet in intervals of, say, ductal shale, because the drilling process isn't going to fracture that shale. That's what you're suggesting, right. I think. Yeah. And I don't have an answer, but I don't necessarily disagree with you either, that it's a possibility. I could talk to the people who did that work.
All right. Why don't we move on to our break here. We'll do a 15-minute break, and we'll start up at 2:45 sharp.